I'm really interested in, and I interrogate often the space that I take up and how my body is perceived and portrayed and how I write about it.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the North American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson. Introducing Lauren Korn, writer, Montana Book Festival director, and soon-to-be host of The Right Question. I'm stepping down from the position of host in order to focus on my writing. This will be part one of a two-part conversation in which I will pass the baton to Lauren. Don't go away. Where does your sense of style come from?
That's a really difficult question, actually. My first inclination is to say that it comes from my mom. She hoarded clothes, and hoarded not in a bad way. She loved clothes, had a really enormous closet, and I love clothes too. We have very similar, or dissimilar styles, I guess. And so I don't know where my style comes from, except that I'm pretty particular. Maybe picky is the better word for it. And I'm very attuned to detail. When I was little, I wouldn't wear anything with buttons on it, not even jeans. I lived in black stretchy stirrup pants. And so I was really particular about anything that I wore. And that particularity kind of persists today. I guess my style is really intentional. And I think that that follows the type of person that I am. I feel I'm a very intentional person. And I think my style reflects that. I tried for a very long time to be a person whose style might be considered effortless, but my body type and, I don't know, my cowlicked hair means that that's actually not the case. That can't be the case for me. And I guess if we're drawing this into writing and literature, I guess as poets and writers, we're always having conversations about intention, right? Especially in workshops, what do you intend as an author when you write something, and how do readers read your work? And I think because I'm such an intentional person, writing becomes the space where that is drawn out, and it's terrifying and chaotic, but it is a very intentional practice.
I should let listeners know that you're seated in across the room from me in a black pullover with gorgeous earrings and a mustard yellow mask, I think with polka dots on it.
Yeah, I'm also covered in clay. I just started taking ceramics classes, so I might be in all black, but I also have like specks of clay all over me right now.
Lauren, I was hoping that you would begin by introducing this crown of sonnets that you've written and actually read us the first one.
Sure. This crown of sonnets I wrote as an introduction to my thesis, my master's thesis, and it was actually the last piece of the thesis that was written. And it's called Table of Contents. It opens the thesis, and it introduces all the threads that kind of happen in this beast of 200 pages of my thesis. And so each sonnet is just 1, 2, 3, so on. But as a whole, it is the table of contents. So 1. The poem opens with my obsessions, an archive of women pooling, their blurred limbs in intimate, soft-spoken public. We are diaphanous, body-shaped butterscotch tulle, fragile confessions, incitements to being and being with, find comfort on the cutting room floor, cold mattress of a longed-for companion. Material effigies strip the saplings of their bark and resolutions from our tongue-married mouths. We cannot remain still. We extend ourselves. Elsewhere, we are apparitions haunting houses, lousy with fruit rot and oversteeped tea. Nothing as it seems, how crucial the holes in our bedsheets. Today, nurture is asking too much of us.
I was hoping we could linger on that last line. Today, nurture is asking too much of us. What did you mean when you wrote that?
So, as I said, I wrote Table of Contents, this crown, at the end of what was this very long thesis process. And the end of my thesis process happened to coincide with the pandemic actually coming on. So I was living in Fredericton, New Brunswick, where I was going to school at the university there. Things were starting to ramp up and close down. I'm a big advocate for people taking care of themselves and taking care of others. But as I think many of us understand now, care is really hard. Nurturing oneself and taking care of others becomes really difficult. And I think that line was literally my thoughts about, you know, sometimes taking care of oneself it's too much to ask.
Lauren, much of your work centers around femaleness. I'm putting that in quotes. You might say it a different way. But you also write a lot about the body, including a number of bits of commentary on body hair. And I wanted to know, what are you circling and writing towards this?
That's a really interesting question, actually. I am a female person, a female-bodied person, who has chosen not to shave my hair on my body. And for a lot of people, that is something worth commenting on and something that I have a very strange relationship to that idea, because at once I am wearing this hair and my body proud, and it is public in a way, you know, in the middle of summer, my legs are bare, and so people can see my leg hair, or if I'm wearing a tank top, people can see my armpit hair. And so in a way, I am inviting a gaze, I suppose, if you want to call it that. At the same time, it is a decision, and it's a personal decision. And so I think when it is publicly commented on, I think that really complicates my understanding of my body and the space that my body takes up. And I think ultimately that's the answer to your question, is I'm really interested in and I interrogate often the space that I take up and how my body is perceived and portrayed and how I write about it.
Moving from hair to other textiles, your work includes lots of images and mentions of fabric, tissue, tulle, wool, and blankets, bed sheets. I want to know your relationship with the textile.
About 3-4 years ago, I took part in a collaborative visual art piece. It was an exhibit at the Holter Museum of Art in Helena, Montana. And my collaboration was writing. I was writing poetry. The collaboration itself was based on a decade's worth of writing letters between me and my best friend in high school. So when we left high school, we just started writing letters. That was our communication. We just wrote letters, and we amassed so many of these really beautiful letters, these beautiful objects. And so when we decided to collaborate on a visual art piece, I decided to interpret some of these letters and turn them into poems. My friend, Elena Razel de Grindakis, she decided to turn these letters into textile pieces. And so our communication and my poetry then became very dependent on and inspired by textile. And since then, you know, I can't say that my writing about textile is deliberate. It's not surprising that it's made itself kind of known in my work, but I think writing And textile, and specifically weaving and the making of textile, they have a lot in common. You know, when you're talking about writing, different threads, the way things come together, the way things overlap, the way different themes speak to one another, I think there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of overlap there. So it's not surprising that you saw that.
I'm looking forward to hovering over the visual element around poetry. But before we leave your thesis, you have a large chunk of your thesis that is based on writing about female envy. And before we leave your thesis, I was hoping that you would read After the Women Who Have Leavened My Envy.
It's funny, Sarah, you've picked up on the things that bookended the writing of my thesis, whereas Table of Contents ended but began my thesis. After the Women Who Have Leavened My Envy actually began my thesis. It was the first poem that I wrote that actually gave me the idea. One of the many pieces of my thesis is this idea about women and the envy I feel in relationship to them and with them. And this poem started that. I wrote this poem and thought, this is an interesting idea. So I'd love to read it for you. After the Women Who Have Leavened My Envy. January is ice beneath blundstones, 4 years worn but never waterproofed. I walk with care robbed of grace. This, and I am velveteen in my sensitivity, wool in my insecurity, handle with care. I toddle in my adult body. I think, someone nope me out of poetry, dismantle my proclivity to worship text. Tell me it will be a radical act of generosity to bury my hollow metaphors in soil. Not everything is a competition, says the mother to her daughter who claims passionately to have been cheated out of sugar. Life begins at whole 30. My body deprived of sugar will, balance restored, digest properly. My bacterial envy and inflammation tended to. It is Tuesday, and my horoscopes have been tucked in for the evening. My legs, too, beneath winter blankets, heaving their weight to an Atlantic rain. The static of my daily solitudes is a stillness I now nurture. Sheets of snow and ice avalanche from rooftops, and in falling, my body recognizes earth. To fall, after all, is our earliest motion. It is no wonder that frigid water surrounds me, attempting to float my ceaseless vigilance. I am frozen, I have fallen, am victim to my namesake. Does this make you the Leucippus to my Daphne, or am I reading too strictly your own interpretation? What does this say, then, about my desire? I want to say, too, Sarah, that two lines from this poem were actually borrowed from other poets. The line about the daughter and the mother, the cheating out of sugar, that comes from Julie Carr in her book Objects from a Borrowed Confession. And then towards the end of the poem, to fall after all is our earliest motion, that's an Anne Carson line.
Thank you. There was a line in here that really stood out to me. I wanted you to address it both like as the speaker and as the poet. I think someone nope me out of poetry. What can you say about that line?
I have a complicated relationship with my writing self. I haven't in my writing life always been a poet. I feel like I came to poetry late, and despite having gone through a master's program and being particularly well-read in poetry at this point, I still hesitate to call myself a poet. And this particular line, I think someone nope me out of poetry. In writing poetry and letting the public see it, or letting my professor see it, other students, my peers see it, no one has yet to nope me out of it. No one has said, Lauren, this isn't working for you. And I think I hesitate to be called a poet because I really question my ability to actually write what is so-called poetry. And so this is just a plea. Someone tell me I'm not good at this, because it's obviously I'm writing it and I want to write it, but I'm pretty insecure in that title.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Lauren Korn about her poetry, relationship with publishing, and recent directorship of the Montana Book Festival. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You exist on both ends of the publishing spectrum, publisher and published. Can you talk about each of these positions for you? For instance, I've heard you speak in really beautiful ways about your desire to simply elevate other people's work.
The publishing industry is a really dynamic industry, which means that there are many different ways to be a part of it. And I've been a part of many. On the back end, I've been an editor of journals and magazines. I've been a reader of slush piles. I do a lot of layout and design work. I facilitated interviews and reviews. And just this year, I planned the Montana Book Festival, which meant programming and reading and planning, a lot of fundraising. And I really love this back end of the industry. What I don't love about it is that it thrives on the free and cheap labor of its workers. So much of the work that I've done for free. I've been paid for some of it, but certainly not all of it, certainly not enough in some cases. And it's also a very white space, a very privileged space, and it perpetuates a canon or a catalog of white perspectives. So we're seeing that change a little bit this year, which is positive, but, you know, it certainly didn't happen fast enough, and it's not happening to the extent that it should. You know this, Sarah, actually. The publishing industry is very slow, right?
Yes.
But I've also been a published author, and it's not a role I'm very comfortable in. So I've spent a lot of time trying and failing, mostly, to figure out why I'm not comfortable in that role, in the published author role. I think a lot of it is a discomfort with taking up that space. But I think even more than that, I'm a bit of a control freak. When your work is out in the world as an author, you have no control over how readers are going to read it. You know, like I said, writing is this practice of letting go, right? For me, it's an intentional practice of letting go. And I'm not yet very good at that. And as you said, Sarah, I'm much more interested in the ways that I can elevate other people in their work. What a pleasure it is to see a piece of writing move from its place in a submittable queue as like a Word document, you know, guiding it through the editorial process or typesetting it or designing it, designing the cover, publicizing it, all of these different, you know, these different roles behind the scenes. There are so many other ways that I can be involved in this industry and I can do what I love and not center myself and my admittedly white, very privileged perspective. And I think what I've learned is that, you know, I can do all of these things in such a lovely combination. I get to be visually creative or I get to edit while championing someone else. In the case of The Right Question, I get to ask questions and I get to kind of put my curiosity on display and do some sort of justice to the book and the authors at hand. And I get to be present for an author in a way that I might not be able to otherwise.
You've brought up design, and I know that you're drawn to design. I want to ask you, when did you first know that you were attracted to the visual element of writing?
So I received my bachelor's degree here at the University of Montana. And while I was a student here, I was the editor-in-chief of the undergraduate literary magazine, The Oval. Not all editors-in-chief take on the layout and design element of the magazine, but I did. And I fell in love with typesetting. And that meant kind of two things. I fell in love with just placing words on a page, spacing things out, where does the title go, how big is the margin, those things. But I also started to really enjoy and love the idea of creating page space with type, and this sort of architecture of the page. So I guess in answer to your question, it wasn't until I began typesetting work that I kind of started thinking about the page differently and became more attuned to the visual page.
What does good design do for writing then? Like, what's the relationship between the words on the page and their visual expression?
I think there are two answers to this question. The first is when we're talking about a typeset page, you don't want the fonts or the designer's decisions to hinder a reader's experience of the work. A well-designed book, a well-designed page is going to enhance someone's reading experience instead of being distracted by loopy, kind of ridiculous fonts. You want readers to focus on the words. So in that sense, the visual element should sort of go unnoticed, if you will. The second part to that, though, is that there's another way that words appear on the page. And I think that in poetry, that happens a lot more often. You get poets or writers creating shapes on the page. Douglas Kearney, for instance, does this throughout Buck Studies, kind of creating this visual architecture on the page, using different fonts and sizes. Yeah, I think that can kind of create a collage effect. And so in those two senses, I think that depending on which sense you're talking about, good design can enhance a reader's experience. Good design can also translate meaning for a reader of a work.
Yeah. You got your master's degree in Canada, and I know that it's easy to say, like, why did you come back? But you moved back to Montana and entered as the role of director for the Montana Book Festival. And I was curious about your intention around what kind of space did you intend to make for writers, knowing that it was going to be all virtual?
I guess I'll preface my answer by saying that I was hired on as the director of the Montana Book Festival in April. And at that point, the world, Montana, didn't really know what September was going to look like. And so I felt pressure. And in hindsight, that pressure was completely internal from me to make a decision about how this year's festival was going to look and how it was going to play out. And I chose to pivot into the virtual space, and rightly so, I think. I don't think it would have been possible to have in-person events this year. But in having a virtual festival, you know, my intent would have been the same either way, right? I wanted to make these spaces for authors to showcase their work. The one thing I will say, though, is that with the virtual space, we had a really unique opportunity to bring authors who wouldn't normally be able to travel to Missoula, Montana, who either couldn't afford it themselves or we couldn't fund here, they could show up. So we had writers from all over Montana, we had writers from all over the country, and we had writers from outside of the country. It was an international festival in that sense. And I think that it made what has usually been a really delightful and scrappy festival so much bigger. It was a really dynamic space.
I was also wondering, what did you learn about how writers are moving through the year 2020?
I think writers are moving through the world like we all are. We're all doing the best we can with the situation and the situations that we are in right now. I will say that writers, and I'm sure other artists, they're in precarious spaces in that people who are publishing books right now are not able to tour. Book tours are a huge part of a writer's ability to get their books into the hands of readers. And so without book touring, a lot of authors are not pushing their books as much. On the flip side of that, you know, authors are being forced to kind of be their own publicity teams. And so in that sense, there are authors out there who are doing a lot more publicity and a lot more pushing of their books. And like I said, of the festival, because a lot of events are being put into the virtual space, authors can have book events all over. I mean, you had to make that choice too, Sarah, right? Your book came out this year and, mm-hmm. and you chose not to tour. And a lot of authors have made that same decision. Additionally, I know a lot of writers who are really struggling to write right now. We're all, you know, like I said, doing the best we can. And for some of us, that means not writing or being unable to write and instead focusing on other aspects of our lives that might need that nurturing, to bring it back, you know, to your first question. People focusing on their skincare routines or walking their dog, and, you know, just things that they can focus on, things that give their life value outside of their writing. I know that I can't write right now, or I'm even struggling to read. What about you, Sarah?
I think it took me a few months to get back to be settled enough to read. And I think writing looks different than it did for me in the before times, as they say. Lauren, you'll be assuming the role of the host of The Right Question now, which I couldn't be more excited about. When I heard you were coming back to Montana, I was like so over the moon. Mm-hmm. What do you think it's important for listeners to know about you?
I don't know if there's anything about me that I want listeners to know, but I do want listeners to keep me accountable to my wish and what I think is a commitment to make The Right Question a diverse literary space. I have a tendency towards reading women and femme-identifying authors, and they will see that reflected in the books that I choose to read and the authors I choose to interview, but I want The Right Question to become a reflection of the diverse literary communities that make up Montana, the West, and beyond. So I really do want to encourage listeners to write in with their thoughts about my choices, as well as with suggestions and questions and even topics for discussion, because I want to know what other people want to be talking about. And beyond my wishes for the show, I hope listeners know that I have a deep love for Montana. And in this position, I hope that I'm, you know, doing everyone proud in that sense. I'm deeply honored to be taking on this role. And, you know, it's a role that you have held so graciously and gracefully. So I'm terrified, but really looking forward to taking it on.
Lauren Korn lives in Missoula, Montana. She's the director of content for The Adroit Journal, chapbook designer for Cutbank, and poetry reader for Ice House Poetry. She recently graduated with an MA in English from the University of New Brunswick. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. Join us for part two of our conversation, when Lauren and I will switch roles. Don't go away.
Sarah, before we dive into conversation, I'm hoping you might be willing to read a poem from your collection. Will you read Whiteout for me?
I will, of course. Whiteout. Here is the place the children I will not have won't miss. Islands hydrographers only suspect and so name with doubt. The search for the neighbors has been suspended. A year's worth of mineral tears and debris no one could find. How many times I also undressed to freeze on that mountainside. In dreams, I pull fistfuls of seaweed at high tide. There are days I lumber into pine shade so I can gaze back on the world without squinting. On this day, though, I would like to be delivered to the thicket's wet center, then left.
Whiteout and many other poems in this collection speak to the idea of naming things, planets, islands, bodies of water, trees, fruit, natural processes. Can you tell me a little bit about your obsession with naming things and maybe where it came from, how it might or might not be intrinsic to your poetry?
I think we name things into existence, into being. And for me, growing up in Southeast Alaska, naming was brought early to me. I mean, like as a child, in terms of locating myself in the natural world, like it was deeply part of my education was learning species, you know, learning the five salmon species, learning trees and plants and understanding the library of the land, in essence. And so I think for me, using the address in a way of naming and calling out is like evocative, you know, as if I'm trying to evoke and invoke the powers of the thing. So of the planet, you know, to name islands, hydrographers only suspect and so name with doubt, right? That's a real thing where I come from. It's an archipelago. And so there are all these islands and it's like, how are you possibly supposed to know these things that get to exist in a bit of mystery? And so to me, naming is like the edge of knowing and not knowing. And we claim as humans to be able to like know and identify all this stuff. But I really actually like the space just beyond that, which is mysterious.
This question may be in line just with that. And Other Bodiless Powers reads to me as an invitation into your vast knowledge base and your experiences in the natural world in such a whimsical way. Sarah, what is your relationship to whimsy?
That's an amazing question. I'll answer that by saying this, which you might appreciate, Lauren. When I was a child, when I was allowed to start dressing myself, I used to wear layers and layers of bubblegum pink. And it would be like tights and then pants and socks over the tights and a skirt over the pants and a t-shirt and a sweatshirt over the t-shirt, over the skirt, over the pants, over the tights, over the socks. And I think that was a great expression for me of like of this whimsy. And I was at turns kind of a shy girl, I think, but also had this sort of burst of enthusiasm. And so whimsy for me was that intersection of like, I don't know how to express some of the more protected parts of myself, but also there's this like enthusiastic part that like cannot not be expressed. So, you know, fashion as a child was one way to do that. But I think that is like, that's magic, right? Whimsy, magic, mystery, wonder. Those are critical, especially when we're dealing in the serious world of poetry.
Will you elaborate on that idea of the serious world of poetry? Does poetry always have to be serious?
No, but I would say for most of us, right, we often first learn poetry in nursery rhyme and in elementary school where poetry exists in a more playful way. And then I think we're taught, you know, somewhere in middle school, high school, college, that poetry has a serious tone. And I think for the commoner, poetry can feel intimidating. And there's something that when you're an adult, it's not very mature to write silly poems, right? Like we sort of, the Shel Silversteins of the world, like that's for children. That's not really for adults. And I adhere to that too. You know, like poetry for me is a refuge for all the complicated, serious things that I meditate on. And so again, like fashion would be a way for me to express the more whimsical parts rather than like writing a rhyme scheme poem. Or does that answer your question, Lauren, at all?
I think it does. Yeah. Yeah, it does. Your collection seems to be also obsessed with motherhood. You proclaim in this collection that you will not have children. Was motherhood something you intended to investigate before you began writing these poems, or was it a theme that showed itself as you wrote them?
I think later in the process of putting together the book, motherhood emerges a clear like theme, through line. It was something I was very aware, and actually, I credit my therapist in this book because, and I think I've shared this before, that I was in therapy, like, I don't know, when I was 33 maybe, and I was meditating on the question of, like, will I become a mother, right? Because 33 is like, the doctors sort of give you, like, 35 is the, like, the gloaming for motherhood, you know? And she said, well, if not a baby, then what will you make? And to me, that was like a shock to my system that I could nurture something else. And that's when I entered the MFA program, was like the following year. Yes, it was conscious and on my mind, but also I didn't ever feel like I wanted to write a book about like to be or not to be a mother, because there are lots of really good books about that already.
Your collection begins and ends with the phrase, "and other bodiless powers," both as the book's title and then the title of its final poem. What words or phrases precede this line? I'm wondering where that phrase came from.
Yeah.
Because in the book itself, that phrase does not follow something.
Right.
It exists on its own.
Right.
And I'm wondering, and maybe you don't have an answer for this question, but in your mind, when thinking about the book, what phrase or words precede it?
So I'll start with the poem, right? Because the title comes after the poem at the end of the book. And that poem came together during a tender part in my life. And I had gone to Bozeman, outside of Bozeman, and managed to find a fly stream and like had managed to like sleep in my car, amble up some fly stream, catch this really beautiful trout, drove back to Missoula, was stumbling around, you know, sort of like brokenhearted, and walked into the Greek Orthodox Church. Its doors were open. It was like a Saturday night. And I stumbled in and was surrounded by these icons and like became this encounter with something that I don't naturally gravitate towards, which is like religion and iconography and like things like that. And all of a sudden I found myself like, boom, like in my body, in the moment, in this church, going like, how did I get here? Like this morning I was fly fishing. So the phrase "and other bodiless powers" comes from Greek Orthodoxy. It's really meant in reverence, though it exists for me in a context I don't adhere to in a religious kind of way. Though growing up in Alaska, Russian Orthodox was very prominent. Like that's sort of the vibe of Southeast Alaska because it was settled by Russians after indigenous people had lived there for 13,000 years. So for me, there's something very familiar and dark about Orthodoxy. So I'll just like say that. But so this poem, and then this poem wrote itself that night. I walk out of this church and I was just like stunned. And then the title came to me. And then as I sat with it and other bodiless powers, for me, I think so much about climate and landscape and obviously this glacier, right? This glacier is this huge piece of this book. And on the cover is this beautiful woman from the 1940s. Staring at the body of this glacier I grew up next to. And to me, "and other bodiless powers" inhabits so much space beyond what we might, what sort of an anthropocentric, like human space that I felt like it could hold. It could hold the book, you know, that phrase was mothering for the rest of the poems.
I think it does, yeah. If you will, I'd like you to read another short poem. Will you read The Auspices?
Yeah, of course. The Auspices. Between wisdom and salmon, balsam root yellows from drought. A bittern stops for squalla. Two cranes take off from the roadside. The labor of awnings in twin flight. What is space for if not longing? All these days, herons in the water, only crooked snags of downed trees stalled out in some eddy. Belly down in six nested pools of hot water, I dream of bee medicine. For once, give me what I ask for, a clutch of eggs, jeweled citrus, no wind.
What is space for if not longing? What are you longing for these days?
It's a transition, Lauren, for me to go from the space I was in of these poems to now, because my life has changed dramatically. Right now, I long for retreat. I long for disappearance. I long for turning sideways into the light, as David White says. I long for the intersection with the unknown in a way that's not anxious.
Do you find yourself anxious right now?
I have days where the weight of the world and my attention to the news and my awareness of the precipice we are facing, you know, wakes me up in a bad mood. And I also have days where I know, because of the way the deer bed down on the mountainside, that really things are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
In an interview with Maine-based poet Georgia Denison, you state that this collection is your call to Alaska, like someone afraid of being forgotten or forgetting. Do you consider your poetics one of memory, of grasping tightly to previous experiences?
That question makes me think about, right, like nostalgia, and how do we encase things with, you know, in like snow globes, cute little snow globes with fondness. Yeah, obviously memories involved here. I want to say honoring is the work, you know, invoking and honoring. It's true, I really am attached to the idea that Alaska knows me as much as like I might know and recall it. But I think I still want, on a cellular level, to feel like, if and when I'm so lucky to have the chance to go back there, that we reunite in a reciprocal way.
You received your MFA in poetry from the University of Montana, and indeed this collection began as your thesis, from what I know. How did the book, your ideas about it, or perhaps even your expectations of what it could become, change from thesis to published collection?
Well, I'm sure, Lauren, as you know, with probably your own writing, is like there are iterations, right? Like where it's like interlocking gears or like a spiral staircase, where I think I just kept circling places and themes and feelings and relationships and longings. And I had to go through a couple cycles of being influenced by my peers in my workshop and my advisors. And then after I graduated, I spent that summer really writing sort of like a large chunk of the book, of course. And then I submitted it for publication. And then a year later, it got accepted. And then I had time to make additional changes. So, you know, if you were to look at my thesis, you know, you would recognize the similarity, right? They're like cousins or like siblings, maybe. But I like to believe that this book is its more whole version, you know, of what I'd really sort of hoped it would be.
Sarah, many Montana readers will recognize the names you cite in your book's acknowledgments, and I want to call attention to two of them. You call poets Sherwin Bitsui and Chris Dombrowski the rock and the river, respectively. Can you explain this metaphor as you applied it to your book or to its making?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for reading so deeply into the book. Like, I just really admire readers who pay attention to the like liner notes. So those two influences, you know, they really came to me my second year. That's when Sherwin was here. And he had such a powerful way of accessing vulnerability. And when I think of Sherwin and the landscape that I understand he inhabits is like very much a landscape of rock and red rock and like sun. And Chris Dombrowski, you know, he's also a Pisces, you know, an angler and a guide, and his book is Body of Water. And it only made sense like that he inhabits such a fluid riverine part, and Sherwin was such like a steady rock, open, you know, sort of like rock is so interesting because it's so like open and exposed rock is such like an amazing thing that we take for granted. And I think like that's just like when I imagine those two people, it's like, oh yeah, so clearly. One was like this very steady, open, solid force, and one was this very like fluid, a human with such personality and such range, right? And so he could be such like a runoff spring or like a late autumn trickle that I just have such fondness for.
What does it mean to be a Pisces and a poet?
It's like a double whammy.
You're currently in the throes of a nonfiction project that centers the Mendenhall Glacier, this urban glacier you, as you said, write about in this collection. What has nonfiction given you that poetry has not or cannot?
Permission to exist on the page in a broad way, right? Like the value of poetry is, for me, is compression. It's a mix of protection and rawness, like where you can be the most guarded version of yourself and the most vulnerable. You know, like I love that I can be so opaque and also so, so vulnerable. And readers will get like, they have no idea, right? Like generally it's sort of like they might have a notion, but prose is like, no, you have to say what it is exactly. You have to really name it. And for me, that is terrifying. And it's the difference between being like smoked salmon in a vacuum sealed package, which is like my poetry, and being like a king salmon thrashing in the water. Like I have to take up space and make sound and call things exactly what they are.
You said it's terrifying. Is it more difficult than writing poetry for you?
Yes and no. I mean, I think like when I was in high school, writing, taking up space came natural to like being a Plutonian teenager. It was like, of course this is important and of course I have things to say. And then I think also my gender training, right, as a woman is like, play small, make your voice small. And so it's a process of unlearning for me to take up space, and I think it's healthy. I think that's what it is. It's like, this is healthy. This is good. And it's a different way of being poetic and lyrical and using images.
I want to switch gears a little and chat about your time as the host of this program. I've been calling this interview your exit interview, which is probably not as clever as I want it to be. But here's my million-dollar question. Do you believe questions are either right or wrong?
Of course not. And, right, I mean, right, the premise of the program is a play on words, the right question. For those listeners out there, like, most of you will know that's W-R-I-T-E. And the question is an art form, you know, the art of the question. And that's the field that I specialize in all of my worlds. And I hope that's what poetry allows, is question. Yeah, and I'll also say, like, yeah, I consider this, like, my goodbye interview and my honoring of people who've supported me over the years, and also my, like, my thrill in having you take over, Lauren. So it's such a pleasure to be here.
You also know how to answer questions because you took what was ultimately kind of a throwaway question and turned it around into something very beautiful. So thank you. In an interview you conducted a little over a year ago with the therapist and writer Lori Gottlieb, Lori said, when speaking to the magic of therapy, what makes it work, that therapy goers are able to tell the truth of who they are in a way that they might be ashamed of outside the therapy room. They're able to reveal themselves. In your day job, you've said this, you're a therapist as well, and it seems like that profession and this one, interview conductor, listener, probably married pretty well. I realize I'm about to ask you to humble brag a little bit here, but how or why do you feel writers on this show were able to reveal themselves to you?
Well, I'm going to start by, like, part of me wants to challenge any assumption that they did. And part of me also knows from the feedback I would get after the interview. So the why, I guess, like, what I would say is my intention with every interview was two or threefold. first of all, it was always to have a good time. Because interviews are stressful, right? And talking about oneself, while I think it's often rewarding for the subject, it's often stressful. So to have a good time. And then second, my goal in reading the book and developing questions was always to honor the work. And if I draw a parallel to the therapy or the consultation room, my intention in that setting is always to leave as much room as possible for people to show up as authentically as possible and to generally leave them feeling like it was worthwhile. And so to me, that is like, that's what I was able to bring. And then obviously my voice is an inherent skill. Like that, I'd like to say my voice and my presence are things I've worked on to make generally something that puts people at ease, which is not always the case, but.
As a friend and someone who has listened to The Right Question under your guidance, I feel like you do, very much so. Which episodes of The Right Question are you most proud of? And where do you think that pride comes from?
A couple come to mind. One was Julianne Okot-Bitek was a really important interview for a few reasons. And she's the author of the book of poetry, 100 Days. It was such an honor to have her on the show, in part because my brother gave me her book. And my brother and I share many things, but poetry is not one of them. And for him to say, I'm carrying around this book in my truck, and we were in the West Texas backcountry, and he was like, here, you might like this. And I read it in one sitting and thought, holy smokes, like, this is the kind of work The Right Question needs. Amazingly enough, she lived in Vancouver, British Columbia. And so the reason I am like, quote unquote, sort of proud is I not only was able to feature like to make room for her work, but also she was Canadian, which like, again, you and I have talked about this, but the Canadian and American publishing industry, they do not intersect in ways that would seem natural. So not only was she in Canada and we were able to cross that boundary, but also she was African and writing about something we don't have enough conversations around. And also that she was such a gracious interviewee. And I think that created a shame-free space for me as a white person to interact with material that made me a little bit nervous. Like, what's my place in asking these questions? And so to me, it was like, that is the kind of conversation I loved having on the show. It's like pushing me outside of my comfort zone, pulling in an author that might not otherwise be heard in Montana, and then having an intimate family connection for me. It was like the dream scenario.
This is sort of in the same vein of what you've just said, but as I move into this role that once belonged to you, I'm wondering what conversations have yet to be had on The Right Question and what conversations need to be had.
I'll approach that question from the side, which is the scope of the show, you know, is authors from the Western United States, but also largely focused on Montana authors. Pre-COVID, that meant authors who were touring Missoula. And that actually limited things in a way. And I was lucky enough to have been granted permission, right, to like go to the CBC in Canada in Calgary and do an interview and like get a hold of a few folks far and wide. But what I anticipate opening up, like being able to interview Pragita Sharma and being able to interview Jeffrey Davis, right, who's in Arkansas but is from the Pacific Northwest, COVID is allowing us to do remote. I know that you have some tricks up your sleeve for inviting more conversations to the table that get to include more voices, elevate more voices, and join national and global conversations that I think the initial scope of the program didn't need to include. Because also this program is now old, you know, it's been going since like 2007. So it's 13 years old and the world is a different place and the needs for conversation are different. And so rather than answer, you know, what are the conversations we need to be having, I know that you'll find your way to them because you are so well-versed in what is already going on. So I'm like really excited to be a listener.
Thank you. I feel like that's a great compliment. And before we go, many of your longtime listeners, I'm sure, want to know where you're going. What are you doing now?
So I'm retiring from The Right Question in part to give myself more space to write and to go into a version of retreat. Now, the month I retired, I got this offer to do Shared State, which, because I am who I am, I have to say yes to things that sound fun. And so I said yes. And so I've been really lucky to transition from The Right Question into Shared State, which feels like a way to use whatever sort of vocal gifts I might have to talk about something important in a time-limited way. So I'm doing that, and I intend to also do some music programs for Montana Public Radio. And you'll find me, ideally you'll find me at my writing desk. That's the goal.
What have you learned about Montana that you didn't know prior to your role in Shared State? And what has surprised you?
Yeah. So I'll start by saying this. When I first moved to Montana in 2005, I was a student in the MSW program, and I was then immersed in like politics and legislative issues and like felt more aware of what was happening in Montana. So this being involved in Shared State has reunited me with a sense of like, where does Montana's political identity come from? How has it been challenged and reshaped over the years? And its constitution, which is really striking in certain ways, is particularly around like the environment.
Really progressive.
Right. Really progressive.
Right.
Right. Yes. You're a Montana gal.
Probably so. Yeah.
The thing that I have learned, which I'll actually quote Sarah Vowell here, is that Montana people, just like the people of Montana, are in some ways far more interesting than its politicians. But oftentimes it's like it's regular folks who become politicians in Montana because we have that kind of state where your next door neighbor all of a sudden is your house district. So to me, that is the most fun, is like we have phenomenal humans in this state who are doing really interesting things and who are complex characters who hold lots of contradictory ideas and who can tell a great story.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining me and passing the torch or the microphone, as it were. I really appreciate you being here.
It's such an honor. I can't wait to hear your work. Look for more information at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast.
Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening.
This has been The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson.
I'm Lauren Korn,
bidding you adieu.